Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr. You're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needleworkers. Our guest this week, Tanya Berlin. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Gary.
Oh, Tanya, we got so many things to talk about here. So many techniques. But first, and see, we're going to do this first because I know we'll get to the end and not have time. I got to learn about your dogs and agility training. Because, I mean, I've known people who did that, but it's usually like little herder dogs and things, you know, the little, and you do it with Old English sheepdogs, and I find that amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I absolutely love it. When I first got my dogs, I first got a Newfoundland, and he's pretty easygoing, laid back. And then I got an Old English sheepdog, and he was quite all over the place, running around. And I thought, I have to do something with this dog to keep his mind active. And somebody has suggested to try agility. I thought, oh, yeah, I think he'd enjoy that. So I took him down, and, oh, my God, it was addictive. I just got addicted straight away.
You did.
Yes, I did. And he loved it, too.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that's the important thing. You've got to have a dog that wants to do it as well. And so we've gone through a whole learning process of about 4 years doing this and both of us improving as we go. And we've been into competition. So last year we were in regionals in Alberta, and we came second in our group. So
Wow.
I'm pretty pleased with that. Yeah. Yes.
Now, Old English sheepdogs just don't strike me as a dog that would be doing, you know, going through little tubes and over ramps, but they're that agile, obviously, yeah. and active.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. I mean, the appearances are they look so fluffy and cute, and I keep mine in long coats, so they really look fluffy and cute. But underneath that, they're skinny and bony, a bit like a greyhound, and if you keep them fit, and yeah, and they're really agile. Yeah. Oh. And so they were bred for herding sheep, so they had to be agile for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and they're really physically quite good at it, and people are always amazed when they see them running.
There's one now.
Yes. I am in the furthest part of the house, but you probably still hear them occasionally.
So basically the hair is deceptive then?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
But they are cute and cuddly still.
So if you keep the hair long, then it's a lot of grooming work.
Oh, my gosh. I spend about at least 2 hours on each dog a week, if not more.
Oh,
so
my.
I spend a whole hour just sitting on the floor watching TV and brushing the dog out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, at least you're multitasking, so that's worth something.
Yes, I get to watch TV at that point. Yeah, that's nice.
So that just sounds like fun because I've even watched on TV those agility things. It's just amazing what those dogs can do. And it's fun to watch the owners because they're always leaning and pulling and all the body motion just to go with the dog. It's like they're connected to each other.
Yeah, it's great. And in Canada, you can run any dog in agility. Well, some countries it's like more specific to border collies and shelties. But in Canada, they kind of welcome all breeds, which is really great.
Yeah.
I mean, mine would be still good, but they wouldn't be competitive against a border collie, which has a much higher ground speed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in their own class, high group. They're with bigger dogs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the playing field is somewhat level then.
Yes. Yeah. And that makes it fair, right? And it makes it fun for everybody and for the dogs too.
Right.
So what, if you've got a dog, give it a go.
No, don't have a dog. I think those things are just fascinating in the way people can get any animal, but particularly dogs in this case, to do those things and do it at such a high level. I just think it's a fun thing. And it's, you know, it's not standing there without moving with your tail pointed in the air. It's, you know, I mean, there's some real skill to it. And I think that's,
oh, yes. Yeah. And, you know, I've learned a lot through the agility and how people might struggle with needlework. Now I understand more because I've struggled in agility. And now I can relate to some of my students when they're going, oh, I don't quite get this. Because for me, needlework came quite easily, but agility doesn't come easy.
Yeah.
So I can relate now.
Yeah.
Much better, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's just a great thing. I just had to learn about that a little bit. That's just fantastic. Yeah. So, all right, we've got, now I'm signed up for your pendant gold work thing where you're testing out a new online teaching program. So, I mean, you teach all over the place. You've taught all over the place, really all over the world. And then now this online thing, but you've done online teaching before?
Yeah. So when I had my first website from the year 2000 to 2017, And in about the last 4 years of having the website, I set up an independent forum. It's called PHBB. And I had that. It's like separate from the website, and I was teaching on that. But now that I have my new website, I've implemented the forum on the actual website, so it's integrated better. So it's easier for the actual student to log in and post in there. And this time, previously, what I have set up the online classes where you get PDF files with work in progress pictures. And as you stitched a piece, you would post your work in progress pictures and I'd comment on it. On this particular class, I've actually done some videos as well of me demonstrating how to do the sewing down the metal threads on the pendant, as well as the PDF file, as well as the instructions, as well as that you can post pictures of your pendant as you stitch it so I can comment, as well as you can ask questions on the forum. So it's pretty rounded online class. Hopefully that it will cover everything you need to know.
And unfair to bring it up because signing up is closed, but
yeah,
I'm excited about it. So basically this way, it allows you to have students who learn in every single way, visually, by hearing.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. That's why I think it's going to be really good. It's good for this particular technique with a metal thread, because sometimes you can not realize the mistakes you can make as you're stitching down the metal threads, where I can cover those and you can watch the videos first to see, mm-hmm. and I can explain, don't do this because this will happen.
Important things to know.
Exactly, because when you're stitching, you might not have thought of those things, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then, so with the needle painting, it's a little trickier for me to do that because there's a lot of work involved with needle painting. So it's better for me to actually have really good instructions and PDF files, and then people do a little bit of stitching, post it, then I will draw on their diagram, their picture. If their stitches are not quite long enough, I can draw onto their picture, like, you need to make your stitches this length instead of the length you have.
Oh, so that okay.
Yeah. That's how I found the needle painting works really well. And yeah. A lot of people have taken the needle painting one, said they've actually enjoyed it as much or if not more than in the class time, because you get actually more valuable time with me in the online class because I can evaluate every single stage. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a class where there's 24 people in the class, you may not get as much time in 2 days.
Right. Right. Yeah. Only so many minutes for so many people. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Do you find that you enjoy online teaching more, less than on site, or it's just different and it doesn't matter?
Just different and doesn't matter, because okay. on site I like talking to people, because really this is the only social activity I get other than my agility.
Other than your dogs, okay.
Yes, my dogs, my husband, who's quite quiet, he's a computer programmer and he likes playing his computer games.
And then, so he's no fun.
Yeah, so he's no fun. Well, he is, but when we do our outdoor activities, fun. But and then agility, yes, there's a lot of chatting all day long about agility. And then, of course, teaching in needlework is really great because you get to talk to people who love needlework and yes. enjoy learning. And I really enjoy passing on my knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Getting people to get better in the technique, not just doing the technique for the fun of it, but getting better in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are in making these videos, has mm-hmm. that been a learning experience, obviously the process of making a video, but also in terms of teaching the techniques, has that made you do things, pay more attention, do things in more detail?
I think I do the same detail in the class.
Okay.
So cause what right. happens in the class, what I do is a demonstration to the student on how to stitch it down. And I explain to them at that point what not to do in Zach. And I'll be doing that in the video. So it will be the same thing that you get in the class. It's just you can get more, it's over a longer time, so you get more feedback. But, of course, when I'm doing the videos, I really have to make sure I cover everything.
Yes.
So I have to, think as I go. And then, of course, there's going to be, as it's live, as I'm stitching, I don't want to have to do this 10 times. So there's going to be a little stumble here and there, right?
Right.
Where
right.
I might muddle my words, so people are just going to have to accept that. But it will still be really, really good.
Yeah, no, I just wonder because oftentimes if you try to offer the same information with a new technique or a new approach, then the light will go on. Wait a minute, I haven't been explaining this as well as it could be, or I've been leaving this out all along. How can I do that? Yeah.
Yeah, that can happen. And that can happen when you're teaching as well. And then a student will ask a question and go, oh, that's a really good point. I forgot to mention that. Yeah.
I might want to put that in the presentation.
Yeah, or in the instructions, right? That's right. Next time I demonstrate that to the next group, I will remember to mention that. So you also learn a lot when you're teaching in a classroom situation from your students, because if they're struggling with something, then you think, oh, yeah, now I really, we have to cover this in a slightly different way or explain it a bit better.
Yep.
So that, you know, because if one person's struggling with it, no doubt several other people are, but not saying anything, right?
Exactly.
So a lot of people keep their mouth shut because they don't want to sound stupid, and it doesn't matter. I'd rather people ask a question and we get them so everybody knows what they're doing rather than somebody going back to Stitch but not really knowing what they're doing.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's. I mean, I'm a former science teacher, and I know that. Yeah, you go to teach any subject, and it'll make you get your act together in a hurry.
Yes, well, if you want to keep on teaching and have people have you back, yes, you better get your act together.
Yeah, no, I'll never. First time in freshman biology, I was doing a segment on spiders, and it was a farm community school, and I did not thoroughly prepare myself, and I started getting an education about spiders from the kids who lived on farms.
And, oh, wow.
That first day I went home that night, I got my act together in a hurry. Cause,
oh.
Yeah, no, that's that. I always remember that. So, yep. You want to teach something or you want to learn something, teach it. Yeah. You'll learn it.
Yes, that's true. That's another thing is, like, you might be stitching for a long time and think, well, I'm not that good enough to teach. But I bet if you spoke to a beginner who had never done that technique and actually went through teaching them, you would learn a lot more yourself, because you would really start to understand the technique yourself more by explaining it to somebody else.
Right. Oh, yeah. 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 And those questions that come back and, oh, how can I, how can I leave that out? Yep.
Yep. Oh yeah. That's a bit embarrassing there when children like show you up, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that was a tough day. I'll tell you, that was a tough day. Yep. Because I got a couple lessons out of kids on spiders, because they deal with them all the time on the farm, and they knew what were poisonous and what bites you wanted to avoid, and they knew all that stuff. And it's like, ouch. Yeah.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. So how did you get started with needlepoint? Is it the standard learn from mom and grandma that got you going? Or not needlepoint, but needlework in general?
Well, my mom, she's a needlework teacher. So she did the City and Guilds course in England. In fact, my mom was from Holland, and she came to England as an au pair, and she met my father in a pub. And
the good old fashioned bar meeting. Yeah. Huh?
Right, the good old fashioned. It's the smallest pub in England, in Salisbury. That's where they met. And so she stayed, and they got married, and then she did the City and Guilds course with the Embroiderers Guild, and then taught her adult education and needlework. So she's done that forever, like since she's about 28 years old.
Oh.
Yeah. And she does more like day classes rather than weekend ones. So her work is really good.
So she's still
good.
Teaching then, huh?
Oh, yeah. She's like 76 and she still teaches.
Oh, that's great. Wow.
Yes. Yes. Because she enjoys the actual one-on-one the group teaching as well. So that she's built friends through that. So she continues doing it. And she's very versatile. She does every single technique as well, but not as like in depth as I do, but she covers every technique. And also she makes boxes, she does construction stuff. So it's just not just pictures, it's just all over the gamut.
Oh.
So when I was a kid.
That's fantastic that she's still doing that. That's just great.
I know. Yeah. I know, isn't it? Yeah, she still does weekend classes for the Embroidered Guilds in England. Yeah, she's pretty cool. Yeah. And so she would like get me to do little projects, little crafty projects and needlework as well. And then I do have the benefit that my granddad on my father's side, my dad's father, he was an artist all his life, a romantic artist. He's very colorful and into wildlife as well. That's me. And so I have the artistic background for my granddad for designing, and then the technique of stitching from my mum.
So you were just immersed in it as a kid then?
Yeah, not that I saw my granddad very often because he wasn't very social. We see him twice a year. He lives 7 miles away and we saw him twice a year.
Oh, my. But, he's an artist. He's entitled.
Yeah, well, we can be a bit reclusive artists.
Yes.
But he was there, art in the house, obviously, from his work. And my mum's needlework around me all the time. And I just had a passion for it. In contrast, my sister had no artistic desire whatsoever. Yeah.
Get me out of here. I'm sick of this.
Oh, absolutely. She sewed for her finger with the sewing machine. It was not a good, you know, so she was just not very handy. Yeah.
Oh, well, it happens.
Yeah.
So that's great then. So then you got art right from as soon as you were aware of the world then. That's great.
Yes. Yeah, and I would like, when I was young, so say 16 or before I went to art college, I would be like walking around in the countryside, sketching or taking photographs. My sister would be off with her friends in the town. I would be out in the countryside, right? Mm. So I would, that's where my interest laid. I was really artistic. Well, I wouldn't say I was a really good artist, but I just enjoyed doing the drawing and then needlework with mum. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the good can come with experience and trying things.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah. Practice always makes you better.
Yeah. So then you run into the Royal School then.
Yeah. So then when I finished school, I did art and it was more fine art based and English. And then after school, I did a 1 year foundation course in art and design. So then you try all different types of art and then you can specialize at the end of the year. And I specialize in textiles.
Okay. Well, help me understand that. So a foundation course just gives you the kind of the waterfront and then to expose you to different things.
Yes, that's right. So we did fine art. We did pottery, textiles, painting. So a whole wide range of different things.
So we tried
a bit of everything. And then because I know I was good at needlework, because I'm really good, and like I was a perfectionist, and I was good at fine art, I specialized in textiles at the end of the year. But the particular art college that I went to was really a modern art college. It was geared towards, you know, slapping it together, burning it, painting it, and it all freeform modern art. And I'm not very good at that. I'm not that kind of brain. Mm-hmm. I enjoy more fine art, realistic. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to go to any of the degree courses like goldsmiths. A lot of people were going to goldsmiths to do the fine art textiles there. And I didn't want to do that because it wasn't really me. So I thought, well, I know I'll go and do restoration instead because I knew I could be a perfectionist in that. So I contacted the Victoria and Albert Museum and they said, yes.
I love that. Give me the stuff where I can be a perfectionist. Excellent.
Yeah. And so I asked them about the restoration course and they said, yeah, we have a restoration course, but you have to have a degree in science for the cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a science background at all. But they told me about the Royal School of Needlework. They had the 3-year apprenticeship course.
Oh.
And so I contacted the Royal School of Needlework and they had me there. I had the 2 interviews, one with the principal at the time, Elizabeth Elvin, and then another interview with the teachers. And then I was accepted onto the course. And then that was from 1990 until 93. And then I stayed another 2 years working in the workroom.
Oh.
So I was completely immersed.
Was that interview intimidating?
A little bit nerve wracking. I had a feeling they didn't really like me.
Oh.
And because I always come from art college and I think they kind of liked people coming straight from school. Where we're a bit younger, a bit more moldable.
Oh, I've heard that. Somebody else mentioned that, that they don't like you coming in with a lot of habits they have to break. Yeah.
Yes. But I did have good technique. So I did show them stitching samples. Anyway, but I was dressed like an art student, you know, really not nice and neat and pretty and all that. You know,
oops.
Well, that's okay. They did accept me on the course. And I think it was either the first or second year I got the highest score in the year.
Oh.
And on my report, it said a surprising result.
Whoa.
I thought, what the hell? I worked really hard.
Ouch.
But, you know, appearances can be deceptive because I'm always like, I'd like to have a lot of fun. Like, outside of the Royal School of Needlework, I joined the university diving group and the caving group. So I was adventurous too, right? So I always wanted to have fun outside of just doing needlework. And I think they thought maybe I was a little wayward or so. So they didn't expect me to be so dedicated, I think, to the actual needlework.
Oh, I can just hear the teacher meetings right now after a day. Oh, that Tanya, I don't know. I just don't know about her.
And I was a little bit outspoken sometimes as well. And whereas a lot of other people might be a bit quieter about things. But I mean, I just speak my mind sometimes and it can upset people. Oops. Oh, well.
Oh, yeah, I can hear it in the faculty room right now. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But saying that, I thoroughly enjoyed my 5 years there. The techniques I learned were fantastic. The teaching was fantastic. The teacher I had at the time, Deborah, she was such a perfectionist as well in stitching, more than me. And I learned so much about technique from her. And I just enjoyed the whole immersion of stitching there. It was wonderful. And so much so that I would go home and stitch every night for 2 or 3 hours after for homework. And that's why I did well during the coursework. Mm-hmm. And at weekends, I would put in at least 5 hours a day at the weekends.
So you were really dug in then.
Yeah, I mean, I did it because I loved it. But yeah. Some people weren't as dug in as me, but I really, really loved it. Mm. So, yeah.
And so you were there 5 years?
Yeah, so the first 3 years were the apprenticeship. And at that time, the apprenticeship, you spent, I think it was 2 months upstairs working on your own design, and then 2 months in the workroom because they wanted to make their money back for, like, your tuition, right? Uh-huh. So you would work in the workroom on the worst jobs, right?
Of course, yeah.
Yes, of course, but that's okay. You have to start somewhere, right? Okay. And then 2 months in the workroom and 2 months in your own work, 2 months in the workroom. And the first 2 years were set up like that. And then the third year, you spent the entire year in the workroom making money for them. But, you know, it worked well because at that time, as it was an apprenticeship course, you were paid minimum wage or below. And because of it, the government gave you housing benefit.
No.
So I never, ever got in debt when I was at the Royal School of Needlework. And now it's a degree course. And I think with the degree course, you probably have to pay for that. And I'm not sure you can get grants or anything. So I can't imagine.
So you were getting the best education and actually getting paid for it then.
Yes. Yeah. I wasn't making money, but I was never getting into debt.
Right.
And that's different from a university course where you pay for an education and then you're in debt at the end of it. Can you imagine being in debt on a needlework degree?
Yeah, exactly.
Then what would you like? It would take years to make your money back. I mean, more than a doctor. Oh, my God. I can't imagine being in debt coming out of a needlework degree. It'd be awful. Yeah, because it's such a hard living anyway.
Right.
And so, yeah. But, it was just like, it was work, but it was fun work. But we did have 2 mature students in my year. And mature students at that time, they were in their 40s. So they were married and they had children. And both students did not make it to the end of the 3 years. I think they both dropped out in the second year.
Oh.
Because the workload was too much. Mm-hmm. So you work all day from 9 to 5 doing your stitching. And then when you get home, you are got put in 2 or 3 hours homework if you want to, like, get good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they would come home and their husband would expect dinner, right? Right. Because it's the old school way then. And then you're tired. And do you really feel like sitting and doing 2 or 3 hours of work? Like, my dinner would be a snack. I mean, I don't really care about dinner. I would just, I don't know, make something really easy and quick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I could do my laundry whenever there's a piled up big enough, not have to worry about the rest of the family.
Yeah.
So.
What is it? What is it? Do the laundry today or go naked tomorrow? Yeah.
Yeah, the Royal School of Needlework would not approve of that.
No, I'm sure not. I'm sure not. Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's too bad. Yeah, that's too bad that, you know, if you have a family and you really want to do it, that, you know, but yeah, there's just a limit to what you can do in a day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you go into a course like that, you already have to keep that in mind, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think in the year that I was in, there was 8 people and we ended up with it's 9 people. We end up with only 4 of us in the end because the 2 mature students dropped out. There was a deaf girl in the group, and which I think would have been fine, but she just couldn't obviously follow visual instructions.
Yeah.
And her quality work wasn't good enough.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then we had another girl in my group, and she was too much of a perfectionist. We would just go crazy with her because she would, for every 3 stitches you put in, 2 stitches would come out. So her progress was so slow. I mean, it was the most perfect work ever, but it would be if you were that slow. and they had to let her go because, you can't have someone that slow working in the workroom because you're not going to make your money back, right?
Right, right.
And it comes down to, in the long run, you have to make a living out of this. And the same for the Royal School of Needlework. They have to hire people who can stitch fast enough to make a living.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of work did you do in the workroom?
So in the first couple of years, it was very uninteresting things for me. Like there was a lot of old samplers that came in that we would just conserve, really. We would darn it and we put a piece of silk net over. We put it back onto an acid-free board and it go back into the frame. There were a lot of tapestries with holes in them. So we would reweave the hole and put in the stitching back. Oh, God, it was so tedious. And for me, it was tedious.
I'm bored just hearing about it. That's just, geez.
And this is why I'm so glad I never ended up in conservation. Because if I had gone into the Victorian Albert Museum and gone into one of their courses, a lot of it is repairing tapestries or just netting them.
Uh-huh.
And I have to have something which will just make me think a bit more, be a bit more creative. But there was one lady at the Royal School of Needlework, and she loved working on the tapestries, just repairing them. And she was a bit older. And I said to her, why do you enjoy this? And she says, Tanya, I've done all the stuff that you've done before, the creative stuff. Like, she's been doing it for years. Now I just want to sit, enjoy stitching, and listen to my radio books.
Yeah.
So she was quite happy just to sit and stitch and just enjoy listening to her radio. But for me, I wanted stuff where I could design or challenging needlework.
Yeah.
And tapestries weren't doing it for me, really. and then you get a lot of just weird one-off things that customers would send in, like cushions which needed repairing, like family heirlooms.
Oh.
A lot of those would come in, yeah.
Mm.
And then we also had some interesting projects like hangings, like banners for certain companies.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of church vestments and altar frontals as well. I think I worked on 4 of those during the time I was there. And they take a long time. They take 6 months sometimes to do the vestments and the altar frontals.
But that's got to be challenging work, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, one particular altar frontal I worked on was it was a boat. I can't remember what the theme was now, but it was the wooden part of the boat, and it was kid leather, and you had to sew down his kid leather.
Oh my!
And yeah, so the first day I was just using my fingers and a needle. Two days later, my fingers were perforated trying to sew for this leather. So then I was using pliers and a thimble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll make you scramble for the thimble in a hurry, won't it?
Yeah. Oh, I don't need a thimble. Yes, I do need a thimble. That hurts.
I'm bleeding.
Yeah, exactly. Don't get beat up blood on the work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gee. Yeah. So then you go through that, and then the last 2 years, then are you teaching?
In the last year, we became assistant teachers. And so we were helping other teachers teach so they could learn how to teach, right? But I didn't do that much teaching there. It wasn't until I left the Royal School of Needlework. I did a bit for embroidery guilds, but not until I got to Canada that I really started immersing myself into teaching. And that's where I learned a lot about teaching as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time at the Royal School of Needlework, there wasn't a specific teaching course. I think they have something more set up now. I'm not sure, you'd have to check with them. But at the time when I was doing it, you were just learning with the other teacher who was teaching.
Oh.
So you just watched them and be an assistant. So,
yeah.
And then you, if it's a good teacher, you you learn some good stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah. Hmm. But I mean, I've taught a lot now. And in the first year in Canada, where I first started teaching at the Purple Needle, they were so, so nice. And I learned a lot from the students there about improving my teaching technique. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll do that. It'll do that to you. Yeah.
Yes.
So then what makes you leave the Royal School then?
Right. So believe it or not, I got totally saturated of stitching, like completely over the top of stitching for 5 years. I thought, it's time for a break.
I don't want to pick up a needle for a long time.
Yeah, I was getting bored, and I get bored easy. So I had a boyfriend at the time for the diving club in the university, and we had decided we're going to go to Malaysia because his dad was living in Malaysia. He was working out there. But we broke up. So I thought, well, you know what? I have the guidebook now. I'm going to go to Malaysia anyway on my own. So I spent a few months reading up in the guidebook about Malaysia and Thailand because I decided I'd go to both those places. And then I thought, one of the other girls at the Royal School of Needlework had spent 8 months in Hong Kong. And so I thought, well, you know, afterwards I can go to Hong Kong and work because then I can even come home, or we'll see what happens after that. So I left the Royal School of Needlework after the 5 years, and then I landed in Malaysia.
I love that. I'm in the Southern Hemisphere. I might as well keep going.
Yeah, exactly. And so I get to Malaysia, and the taxi driver takes me to Chinatown. So I say, the backpackers is in Chinatown. And he goes, you sure you want to get out here? I said, yeah, this is where the backpackers is. He goes, you sure? I said, well, yeah. He says, I said, where is it? He goes, I think it's up that road. And he didn't even want to drive me up the road to the backpackers.
Oh,
I know. So I got out with my backpack, and I thought, all right, I'm going to head up the road and just hope for the best. And I saw a Caucasian guy. So I thought, maybe he speaks English. So I asked him if he knew where the backpackers was. And he said, I've stayed there when I first came here, and it's a good one. And so that's where I went. I went to the backpackers and then started traveling. At that time, it was really good because you meet other travelers who, you know, there's a lot of single women traveling, more than men, and more than couples as well. So I met other single travelers in the backpackers, and we would travel together. But on the whole, I would be on my own more than traveling with a group, because I would like to spend 2 or 3 or 4 days in a place where most people would want to spend 1 day in a place and then move on.
Oh.
Whereas I like to spend a few days in a place, get myself immersed and really, you know, see the environment and then move on. So I was more of a loner in that sense. But you're never alone, because in those backpackers, you meet lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I traveled from Malaysia, Thailand, and then I went to Hong Kong, and I spent 8 months there working in the bar. My intention was to be there 3 months and work in the bar and get enough money, but Hong Kong just soaks your money away by drinking because there's nothing else to do. Yeah, I know, there's nothing else to do in Hong Kong. So you go to the bar with your friends, and then the money you save gets eaten up real quick. And I mean, not heavy drinking, but just socializing, right. And so after 8 months, then I went to the Philippines for a month, and then I went to Australia. And about 5 months into Australia, I was at a backpackers and I was working. I was picking tomatoes, and I met a guy from Canada, which is my husband, Russ. And so we spent another month or so or two there at that backpackers, getting to know each other. And then we decided to travel on together. So we bought a tent and we hitchhiked across Australia. I'm backpacking. Would you
across
not know
the continent?
Across Australia.
Wow.
And like got dropped off in the middle of the bush, and then people I think we're pretty brave now when I look back at it.
Yeah.
If there'd been a bushfire or something, we might have been. Or also the backpack murderers there's been several backpack murderers in between the times that we've been there.
Oh.
So yeah, they pick up backpackers and kill them. But so yeah, we were lucky, but we saw lots of Australia. And so I was spending a year and a day in Australia, and then we flew out of Victoria, I believe, and we went to New Zealand, and we stayed with my friend Joe Dixie. Joe Dixie was in the year below me at the Royal School of Needlework. She also does needlework now, but her own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we toured us. We bought a minivan, a camper van in New Zealand, and we toured there for four months. And then we left. We went to the USA, and then we traveled up the west coast of the USA back to Canada, and then we got into Canada.
Oh.
And Russ had always said to me, oh yeah, Calgary is close to the mountains. So I was picturing this city in the mountains, yeah. But Calgary's in the prairies and it's about an hour. And we arrived in February where everything is completely brown. There's no green whatsoever. Calgary itself is fairly flat and it's only 130 years old about. And so there was no history to it at all and some very ugly areas. And and I thought, oh God, where's he brought me to? I was so disappointed it wasn't in the mountains. And it took me probably 8 years before I really started feeling at home. And I think another reason it took so long was because I was so concentrating on needlework in my own house without actually going out and doing stuff as much as I used to do. Like I used to do the caving and diving. Mm-hmm. And so one time I was in the USA and they had this guy doing djembe drumming at one of the events, at the needlework events. And I thought, I know, I'm going to do that when I go back to Canada. So I did a class in djembe drumming, the African drumming. And I met a friend through that. And so then I started a social life, and that's when I started feeling at home in Calgary, because then I started having friends. Oh, friends outside of needlework. So I was going to the Embroiderers Guild every month, but I was like 28, 30 years old, and everyone else is in their, 50s and 60s, right? So there was no one of my age group there. So when I started doing the drumming, there were people of my age group, which is, you know, just so you can relate a bit more.
Sure.
And then once we got our own house, we got the Newfoundland and then the old English sheepdogs. And from the dad with the agility, I have a social life too. So now, you know, it would be hard for me to move from here now.
Now, while you were traveling the world, did the stitching just sit on a shelf? I mean, or were you doing some needlework?
It sat on the shelf. I was in Australia and I wanted to make a little bit of money. And I went to the needlework store there and I said, I can do commissions if anyone wants one. And a woman had commissioned me to do some geisha, like Japanese, a couple of ladies to demonstrate the thread. Mm-hmm. And so I stitched that for her and she was really happy with it. And probably have it a little surprised because I did have my photograph album with me of what I can do. But, you know, when you commission someone and you don't actually see the embroidered pieces, it's probably a little bit risky. But she was really, really, she was really pleased. But it really was on the back shelf. My interests weren't really there. I wasn't settled enough in one place. And I wasn't that much of an addict that I wanted to continue as I was doing it. I kind of drift in and out of things. So, but when I got back to Calgary, settled in Calgary, then I got fully immersed in it. Back into needlework again, and it comes back really quickly. So I had a two and a half year break from stitching, but
so you just like, you just needed that break from the school then.
Well, really, because if you're stitching in like 6 to 7 hours a day plus extra in the evening for 5 years, that's a lot of stitching. You can get a bit too much, right? You get jaded, right? It just gets a bit too much. Well, for me, I like variety. So, and that's why I have a lot of different things going on in my life right now, not just stitching.
Yeah, you don't sit still very, very well, from what I can tell. Yeah.
A lot of people say, I don't know how you have the patience for the stitching, because I want to do active things like the agility and, you know.
So you get to Calgary, and then so the stitching comes back and
So when I got to Calgary, I thought, what the hell am I going to do? It's like the only qualifications I have is needlework. Oh, or maybe working in a bar in Hong Kong. And that's not kind of I don't really want to do bar life. And, you know, it's the environment. Everybody was smoking at that point. So I thought, well, at the time, Calgary had 5 needlework stores. That's how popular needlework was at that time. Yes, 5. So there were 600,000 people at that time, 5 needlework stores. There's 1,400,000 or 1,300,000 here now. And there's no needlework stores in Calgary itself. There's 2 on the outskirts of Calgary.
How times change,
Yes, well, it was lucky for me, hey, that they were here when I came here.
Right.
So... So the first place I went to was the Purple Needle, and it was a really great environment in there, a very social, busy, people come in and stitch, and yeah, it was lovely. And Shelley there, I showed her some of the pieces I embroidered, and I said, would you like me to, because when I got to Calgary, I actually stitched up some examples of a needle painting, because I didn't have any of my embroideries with me. One of them was a dog that I gave to Russ's mum, of her dog, and then a couple other animals. So I said to Shirley, would you like me to teach this technique? She said, oh, yes, please, because they hadn't seen this technique in Calgary. So, and she said, well, you'll probably have to come up with a small, you know, easier design. I think the first class I did with them was animal portraits. Mm. But then I realized with teaching that, it was just a bit too involved, you know, too advanced for beginners.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then I came up with the wild rose. And when I designed that, I thought, well, let me design this with the elements of people that people can learn from it. Satin stitch and long and short stitch, right? French knots. So I actually was more thoughtful about designing for teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ladies in one of my classes, the very first class with the animals, she got so frustrated when she was trying to stitch the piece. And she was like in tears.
Oh,
she
my.
Said, "We'll be yeah. And I didn't realize. And she said, would be so much easier if you can stitch some direction lines in. Because when we do needle painting, we draw the angle of the stitches that we want on the actual embroidery.
Right.
And she said, well, it'd be easier if there were stitched in directions. And I said to her, that's a very good idea. So what we do now is we stitch in some guidelines along the actual piece, not really close together, but mm-hmm. for the angle that we need in the color that we need, and then just fill in between. And then it's easier to keep your angle. Because if you have just a drawn pencil line on the embroidery, your eye forgets it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a stitch in there to follow, then your eye easier fills into that stitch.
Yeah.
So I learned from her that that would be a good method. So listen to your students, right?
Yeah. Did you save her as a student? I mean, did she?
Yeah.
I mean, that's some dedication to be in tears and then.
Yeah, she still carried on with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was a while ago. That was like 19 years ago now.
Oh.
Yeah, God, that sounds a long time. Yeah. Yeah, no, she continued stitching, but I felt really bad for her. But once we got past that, yeah, she carried on.
Yeah, okay.
Unfortunately.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Good.
I've only had one other person cry in my class, and that's in 19 years of teaching. And she was upset because when I do my demonstrations, what I do is I break up the class into, say, four or five groups, and I demonstrate the same technique to each group.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back and stitch on it, and then I bring the groups up again. Now, if there's a faster group of stitchers, I'll have them up first, so they're not sitting and doing nothing, right?
Right.
Because otherwise they'll get bored, and I don't want anyone sitting and doing nothing. So that means that some of the slower stitchers, as in slow speed of stitching, not in mind, but they're just slower in speed, they might be in the last group. Well,
mm-hmm.
she got upset, but she didn't tell me this, because she thought she was behind because she was in the last group. No one's behind when they're in the last group. It's just their speed might be just a bit slower, so I will do them last. But usually on the next day, what I do is I start with the slower group because we're doing something new, and then we'll go that way. So I just have to be aware that people are not going to get upset because they think they're behind, because no one's behind. Everyone gets to learn what they need to do, but...
Right. Right.
No, not everyone's going to be the same speed.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Oh, the dynamics. The dynamics of classrooms. Yeah.
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 I want everyone to be happy, right?
So right.
That's not
fun
if someone's upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I remember those days. That's okay. But now if we look at your website and all of the kits, techniques you have, mm-hmm. I mean, there's black work. There's, I don't know how many kinds of white work. Gold work, counted cross stitch, counted canvas, cross stitch, needle painting, a couple kinds of lace. Do these all come from your years at the Royal School, or are they things that you've just picked up through the years and added to your repertoire?
The only one that hasn't come, the only couple of things that haven't come from the Royal School is Carrick Macross lace. And Carrick Macross lace is very similar to fine white work, which Royal School Needlework teaches. And the reason I started doing the Carrick Macross lace is when, when was I having a mental blank now? And this is what I The royal wedding, what, who got married?
Oh.
You know, she was wearing...
I'm not very good at that. I'm not. I don't follow those things.
I know. I'm English and I don't. William and... What's her name? People are going to kill me. Kate. When she got married, her dress was inspired by Karen McCross lace. So I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. I want to have a look at that. So I purchased a kit from Ireland on how to do the technique. So I wanted to understand the technique compared to fine white work, which is very similar. And then I did a sampler instructions on how to do the actual technique. That was really fun to do. The other one that I that wasn't taught at the Royal School of Needlework is the Hapsack lace, which is just canvas work stitches. And I just do that because I find it really easy to do, right? Mm-hmm. So if I want to design something easy, I'll design that and I can take it on the road with me and just stitch it on the road, and it's just one color, and so I don't have to worry about it. Whereas I don't take my needle painting and gold work with me on the road to stitch, because it requires too much concentration for me and the right lighting and stuff.
So you're and it seems from your designs that you're able to just bounce from technique to technique without any trouble. So you've obviously studied and used all of them rather extensively then.
Yes. The Royal School of Needlework, you get a lot of practice and techniques, but there are some techniques I haven't continued with, like hardanger, most of the white work ones, except for the fine white work ones. So I think personally, if you are really practicing one of the technical techniques like needle painting or black work, it's easier to transition to another technique, because your hand is already practiced and your brain is already practiced as well to visually see the stitching, right? It's not so easy to go from cross stitch, say, to other designs, because cross stitch is quite easy. It's just a basic stitch, right?
Right.
But if you're doing needlepoint and you're doing all the different canvas work stitches, and then you wanted to transition, say, to a surface embroidery, it's going to be easier for someone to do that than it would be for somebody who has had no experience, because your hand is already practicing the technique of stitching. Yeah.
So that's because, see, I'm a firm believer that needlework is one of those arts, hobbies, crafts. I don't like calling it a craft. I think it's much more than a craft. But one of those areas where a technique in one area transfers and really helps you move to another one with less resistance, with less little lower learning curve. And I think that's one of the great things, is you really can transfer those skills with just some modification and experience completely different worlds.
Yes, I agree with you totally. I do. And it's just, I know people get stuck on the thing that, oh, I'm a counted worker, but not a surface embroiderer. But I'm both. I enjoy all techniques. And I've been lucky, because I've been taught in all techniques, right? So, and I think it's good to bridge out, because I think it's better for your brain to learn new things than to be stagnant and stay in the same technique all the time. I really think it's better. And if you are intimidated about doing something like needle painting and you're a counted worker, the best thing would be to do is try and take a class, because then the teacher will try and get you over that barrier, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that be in class, in person, or an online class. If you don't try, you're never going to get better. And I've learned this from agility. Agility is one of the hardest things to do, because you're not only having to train yourself to handle correctly, but you're working with a dog who can do what he wants, right?
Yes.
So you've got a team partner there who can be quite erratic. Now, take Monty, for example. If I don't tell him exactly what I want, he'll decide what I want, and he'll go, well, she didn't tell me, so I'll just go into that tunnel there.
Oops.
That tunnel looks like fun, so I'll just run off in that direction. So you've got to be so specific. So you have to, you know, and the same with needlework. If you don't try different techniques, how are you ever going to improve your stitching skills? I mean, fine, you may not want to. You may want to just come home from work and do something easy. Or you might be more like me, who wants to experiment and try different things and just feel like that you're growing in something. Growing, you know, you're not just staying in one spot, but you're growing. And you never know, you might find something you really like better than what you're doing right now, right?
Yeah. People who say, oh, I've lost my enthusiasm. That's kind of my automatic response. Then go try a different technique.
Just
take a whack at it. Because exactly, you might find you really like it a lot more. If nothing else, it'll just make you think differently. And then if you don't like it, what are you out? You know, so what?
That's it. Exactly. And it's a relatively cheap hobby, depending. So my actual kits are very inexpensive for a lot of instructions, for a lot of hours of work that you get out of it. For a Nina painting kit, it costs you like, I don't know, $58, which is less than American. It's like $45 or $30. And you get probably, I don't know, months of stitching out of it, right? So that's a really cheap hobby compared to, you can go and have a massage and pay $75 for a massage, you know, and that lasts you for 1 hour.
Right.
And you have nothing to show for it.
Right. Yeah. By the next day, you're all tense again.
Exactly.
No, so that's that argument, that perspective on needlework is if you take it to for your cash outlay, how many hours of enjoyment? Yeah, it gets to be real cheap in a hurry.
Yeah, that's it. And it's like stuff you can do in yourself at home. You don't have to go out, you know, if it was cold and wet or snowy, you don't have to worry about going out. Yeah.
Yep.
So,
that's just it. And you have something to show for it at the end. Yep.
That's exactly it. Because you can sit, you might be tired after a day of work and you sit in front of the TV, but you have nothing to show for it at the end. Or if you go to a movie, you don't have anything to show for it at the end, right?
Yeah.
With needlework, you've actually practiced your brain and improved your skills, which will be good for your brain in the long run. So.
Well, that's just a good marketing campaain right there.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, everybody. I'm not trying to sell my stuff.
No, I mean, in general, for the hobby in general. I mean, it really is. There's just an awful lot of pluses to it.
Absolutely. And, I think any hobby that you do with your hands and your brain is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just keeps you going longer.
Yeah.
That's what my mom says. That's another reason my mom says she carries on teaching. She says, I think if I stop, I think my brain would go downhill pretty quick after that, you know? So it keeps her mind active. And same with my father. He still teaches. He teaches philosophy, and he does that twice a week still, and he's 78.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Keep the wheel spinning. Yep.
That's it. Yep. Exactly.
All right. We're going to have to wrap up here, but I got to know about these long distance hiking. So the West Coast Trail?
Yeah, West Coast Trail.
Tell me about what it's like to hike a distance like that.
Oh, horrible.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we did that when we first came to Canada. So probably 2002 or 3, I can't remember now. And so you take all your food with you on your back and your tent and your cooking supplies. And we went for 10 days. Most people do over 6 days, but I know my stamina for hiking 8 hours in a day is not going to have, I won't be able to do that.
Yeah.
So we went for we hiked for 4 to 6 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first day was brutal because it was literally vertical climbing up and down rooty, wet, and over logs in the forest, right? In the rainforest on the west coast of Vancouver Island. My legs hurt after the first day, so bad. And it doesn't get any better. Probably the last day is the best because it's flat. But, I mean, it was really lovely. And I'm kind of glad we spent the extra time because we would get to the camping areas earlier so we could find a nice spot and just relax a bit. People were coming in at 8 o'clock at night and then they'd be out again at, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Ooh.
Where we would start later. Well, we start about 9 and we get in about 3 or 4. And we saw some whales out in the sea and hummingbirds and stuff like that. But it's fairly popular trail. So the only thing is, you're not really secluded out there. There are other people hiking it as well. So if you want to be on your own, the West Coast Trail is not the place to go.
Okay, because I wondered that if you were just completely isolated for long periods of time. But yeah. Not at all. Huh?
No, yeah. No, no, there's loads of people hiking that. Now, we did a canoe trip in Wells Gray Park. Now, that was isolated. Oh. That one was where you do a loop of lakes and then you portage between the lakes. Mm. And we pretty much, well, most of the time we were on our own, we saw a few other canoers when we were out there. And it's in grizzly bear country. And the first night that we camped, well, I woke up and I looked over, my husband was going, shh, bear. And oh, he looked like, he was lying there and he looked really, really frightened. And I took my earplugs out and I could hear him breathing as he was circling the tent.
Oh, my.
I know. And then, you know what I did? I put my earplugs back in. I didn't want to hear it.
Just like an ostrich. Can't see you, you're not there. Good.
Exactly. So it went off and tried the bear bins and then it left. And so that first night we had the bear spray in the tent. And then after that, we kept the axe in the tent instead, because we're thinking if we let that bear spray off in the tent, we would have just gotten plastered ourselves. Right.
Right.
With the axe, you may have had more chance, but anyway, so when we got back to the, camping, to the main area, we reported back in. And we said, oh, yeah, a bear circled the tent. She said, the gamekeeper, where it is, the warden, said, did you see what type of bear it was? And we said, no, we are not going to open the tent to see, hello, what type of bear are you? That was a funny question.
Oh, my. Nope, yeah. Nope, didn't leave a calling card, sorry.
I just thought it was the funniest question.
Oh, man, yeah, no. No, yeah, we were just trying to not be noticed. Thank you very much. Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Oh. So it was an adventure. That was a really cool trip. Glass-like lakes in the middle of grizzly bear country, mountains. Oh, it was wonderful, really wonderful. But unfortunately, we haven't been able to do trips like that because now we had the dogs, right?
Yeah.
And that means putting the dogs into kennels. And we just have, we go through phases. We just haven't been motivated, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, that takes some motivation to do a trip like that, yeah.
Yes, yes, definitely, yeah.
Oh.
But definitely worth it.
Oh, yeah, I got to believe it is, yeah. Memories that most people never get close to, yeah.
Well, exactly. Like, I'd like to create memories and doing things like this. Let's hope I keep my mind so I can remember these things.
Well, you will. You will. All right, Tanya, really enjoyed it. Thanks for taking the time. Really, really fun, yep.
Yeah, thanks, Gary.
All right, thanks to everybody for listening.